One of the things that I love the most about being a chaplain at New Covenant is I get to be around all kinds of very smart people, smarter than I am, and get to learn things that I didn't know about before. I have a student right now who is writing his senior thesis about Napoleon. And I can honestly say I know just about nothing about Napoleon. But one shot at YouTube, you know, to type in something about anything, and all of a sudden you just get covered up, right? They just start feeding you everything that might relate to that. And there was a video about the Battle of Austerlitz that I had known just from way, way back as being a big deal, but I didn't know why. The Battle of Austerlitz is considered to be one of the greatest battles ever fought in the history of warfare. It's like the Battle of Cannae that the Romans fought against Carthage. Austerlitz in the year 1805 was fought in the part of the world that is now Czechoslovakia, but in the day it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. As a matter of fact, that's not exactly true either. It was part of the Holy Roman Empire that still existed at the turn of the 19th century. Napoleon had been battling against the combined forces of Austria, England, the German princes, and had largely been successful against them. But England, of course, always looking for a reason to wind up another battle to defeat their supposed enemy in Napoleon, were able to persuade the Austrians to once again threaten Napoleon's northern border. Napoleon sent his army north and defeated the Austrians at Vienna, and then turned to face the onslaught of the massive Russian army as it approached from the north. Always the big Russian army. That's what we're always afraid of, right? The Russian bear. Napoleon, who was under his army was undersized at about 70,000 men with 150 cannon, proposed a ruse for this larger force, 85,000 combined Russians and Austrians with more than 300 cannon and twice his cavalry size. Napoleon sent his army north to make contact with the Allies, but then when they came in sight, turned in retreat, but it was all a fake. Desperate to lure the Allies into battle, Napoleon pretended that his army was weak, defeated, and in disarray after his battle for Vienna. He even, having figured out where the battle would occur, he even gave away the high ground known as the Pratzen Heights, the high ground in the middle of the battlefield that gave whoever held it survey of all the surrounding area. He even allowed the Austro-Russian army to take the heights, and he deliberately weakened his right flank, apparently showing that this was the place where they could take advantage of his poor planning. But what the Russians and the Austrians didn't know was that Napoleon was expecting the soon arrival of Marshal Davout, who was on a forced march coming from Vienna with another 30,000 men. Can you imagine marching 70 miles in 48 hours? That's what I mean by forced march. Under a heavy pack, carrying all of your equipment and supplies with you, 70 miles over rough terrain in 48 hours. Of course, Napoleon was gambling. He expected that Davout would make it, and would plug the hole in his right flank that he had been showing, teasingly to the Austrians and the Russians. The Russians and the Austrians took the bait. They stacked all of their army over on their own left wing, on Napoleon's right, and attempted to crush his right wing and roll up his line. But Napoleon was able to hold as Davout arrived to support his right flank. Then Napoleon struck, as he said, one fierce strike and the battle will be over. He sent his fourth corps, led by Marshal Soult, directly up through the middle in the midst of mist, where the Russians couldn't see him approaching, and then the artillery barrage that followed as they pierced the Allied line, completely sending the Russians and the Austrians fleeing for the hills. The French swept through both sides of the flanks and sent the Allies packing. Napoleon, that day in 1805, lost 8,000 killed and wounded. The Allies lost 30,000 killed, wounded, and captured. But it also signaled the end of the Holy Roman Empire. It would never exist again. Francis II, the Holy Roman Emperor, was left with just Austria. He was now just king of Austria. The Russians, as a force, were demolished and demoralized, sent packing off to the north. England, isolated on their own little wet island off the west coast of Europe, Napoleon stood master of all Europe on a ruse. Brilliant. One of the most brilliant actions on the field of battle ever. And it also turns out that Tolstoy thought so too when he wrote War and Peace, which is what Mrs. Morse and I have been binge-watching lately. So if you're looking for a good show, BBC 2016, very nicely done, although Carl Curtis warns me that it's not as good as the one with Anthony Hopkins back in the 1970s. But there you have it. So the Battle of Austerlitz, one of the great battles in the history of the world. I wanted to tell you that story because of the fact that, of course, we need heroes. All of us need heroes as we live our lives, often of drudgery. We imagine that this is this world of paying, as my son tells us, being an adult is about paying your bills and going to bed early. And he did say that to us. And so often our lives are left with that. And so heroes and heroic actions are necessary for us. But I want to tell you today, and I hope that you've noticed the theme in our hymns and also our readings today, that the Christian life is as much a battle as Austerlitz ever was. But it's not against flesh and blood. But as we hear from St. Paul, the Christian life is a battle against principalities, against powers, against rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. That is, the rulers of this world that can seemingly control the heights of the battlefield there. They are the ones that oppose us. And it's so often the case that we look around the church as we see it, the 50 or 60 some odd here in a lunchroom, and we say, we are powerless. We lose our hope. We lose our spirit. We feel like that we have lost the field. But the case is far different in reality. God has already won the victory in his Son, and now he has given us his Spirit that we may surely win the battle. You see, the world demands that we remain relevant. They try to take our weapons from us before the battle has even begun. The world says, there's no use fighting. You need to quit being so antique or antiquated. You need to get with the times. You need to be up to date. You need to make concessions to be a real modern human being. Modern morality, to coexist. See the bumper sticker all the time, written in those strange symbols there to spell out the word coexist. That the battle is not worth fighting. But I hope that you understand that we are in the midst of a battle, and it is worth fighting, and we are the heroes of the day. God has given us his power in his Spirit to take the heights against the enemy. It's so often the case that we think that being Episcopalian means that we're smarter than the average Christian, right? We're the ones that, as someone said, being Episcopalian means not checking your brain at the door, as though, you know, the higher rationale gives us this kind of religion that is, you know, appropriately modern, appropriately intellectual, not like those kind of raving Pentecostals over there who are dancing in the aisles and things like this is where reasonable people go to church. As if to say that being devoted to the Christian faith, once delivered to the saints, is unreasonable. But I want you to know, and I want you to be encouraged, and I want you to be ready to fight the battle against a world that seeks to destroy the Christian faith, to establish a world in which only wealth and power and influence is the truth. No, we as Christians, we declare Christ crucified. We declare Christ risen from the dead. We declare that we as God's children have hope for the victory, which is the defeat of all the powers of darkness and death. So Paul encourages us to take up the whole armor of God. God doesn't send us out like babes in the wood with no defense, as though we're supposed to run through machine gun fire with no protection at all. No, that's not the case at all. We are to do battle and we are to be armed. And Paul gives us the laundry list, the belt of truth, the breastplate of righteousness, the shoes of the good news, the gospel, the shield of faith, the helmet of salvation, and the sword, which is God's word. All of these we are to take up, and we are to be grateful and confident in what God has done for us in all of these weapons. But above all of these weapons, Paul says, we should take up the shield of faith. Above all of these weapons, we should take up the shield of faith. What does that mean exactly? Well, faith is not simply rational assent that Jesus existed or even that Jesus died. That's not what faith is, some kind of rational assent about a certain number of historical data points. No, we see in our gospel lesson today that Jesus heals the nobleman's son without any evidence at all. The man believes Jesus' power without seeing the result of Jesus' words at all. Jesus says to him simply, go your way. Your son is healed. And the man said, done. I'm out of here. I have nothing left to say to you because I believe you. Whatever you say to me, I believe it. And he turned and went his way. And the evidence, of course, came subsequently. He asked his servants when his son began to recover from his illness, and they said about the seventh hour, and the man knew that that was when Jesus said the word. But the shield of faith that this man wielded against all of the doubts of his life, the doubts about his son's own health, failing health, he fought with the shield of faith. He believed Jesus's words just because Jesus said them. And Jesus healed his son, as he says, according to his faith. You see, faith, as the church has always taught, is a virtue. Faith is the strength that we not only are given by God, it is a gift to us, but it is something that we cultivate. That is, we strengthen by practice. It's not a virtue if you say, well, I received the faith at my baptism or at my confirmation or when I was converted, but I'm rather skeptical since then. That is a shield unused. That is a shield that's hanging behind your door with your umbrella and your raincoat. It is of no use to you if you do not use it. So faith is that virtue that we wield in the midst of the moments in our lives in which we are most at risk of doubt, most at risk of fear, most at risk of leaving the safety of the faith. Faith is that weapon that we use to protect ourselves against the skepticism and the immorality of the world that surrounds us. So we are to wield, above all of these weapons, the shield of faith. How is it that we are faithful? How is it that we wield that shield of faith? Well, like Alcoholics Anonymous tells us, the first step that you must take towards sobriety is that you have to admit that you have a problem. It's no use to you as a Christian to go through your life whistling past the graveyard, so to speak, by saying, mumbling to yourself again and again, I am not at war with the world. I am not in the middle of a battle. All of these people around me that make these terrible remarks, they just don't understand me. If they knew who I was, they wouldn't be so aggressive towards me. To deny the battle is to lose the battle from the outset. The first step toward wielding the shield of faith is to admit that we are at war against the powers of sin and darkness and death, against the world, the flesh, and the devil. Every time that we step out into the world, we have to devote ourselves again in faith to our Lord Jesus, who himself died at the hands of his enemies and rose again in the power of his Father's life. Every moment in which we live our lives, we must be ready for the temptation or the attack of the enemy. Each temptation that we receive in our lives, no matter how small, is the battle. It's not as though you have to wait for Austerlitz to happen, to hear the gunfire and rolling across the hills of Austria, to know that, oh, I'm in a battle. Each temptation that we come to, no matter how small, is the battle itself. They are maybe small skirmishes, but they are moments for us to be truly faithful, to wield the shield of faith. We don't wait for someone to offer us drugs or to invite you to rob a bank or to have sex before you're married to say, oh, I'm going to try out being faithful today. You should have been practicing being faithful before that moment so that when the real clash occurs, you won't be taken by surprise, that you will be ready, you will be practiced, you will be strengthened in your faith before the great controversy occurs. Cheating on a quiz at school, being lazy at work, gossiping about people that you don't like, using bad language when your parents can't hear you because that's cool. Those are all examples of losing the little skirmishes before the big battle arrives. Building yourself up at other people's expenses. Using harsh words with your wife or with your children. Those are all examples of how it is that we come to moments of temptation and invited to wield the shield of faith before the big battle ever occurs. It's so sad that a vast majority of married couples who end in divorce and they go to counseling, and counseling doesn't help any. They come at the last moments in which they can't speak to each other anymore. Perhaps they live on opposite ends of the house, or maybe one of the spouses has moved out, and they seek as a last gasp to go to counseling, whether with the priest or with a counselor. And then they shrug their shoulders and throw their hands up and say, well, we tried, as if to excuse themselves for their failed marriage. It's just not true. They missed the battle before it even began because they did not fight against the temptations of the devil. All those little moments, all of those little hurts and offenses in their marriage before it came to that last great break. So, we should not wait for someone to actually challenge our faith directly or to be tempted to great sin or failure before we practice using our shield of faith. We must practice with our armor. David refused to use Saul's armor when he fought the Philistines and, of course, the great Philistine Goliath. We often read that and say, well, it's because of the fact that Saul was a big man. And David was a little boy, and that's the reason why he didn't wear the armor. But that's actually not what the text says. What it actually says is that David was a great man of battle already, that he had already defeated bears and lions who were trying to eat his father's sheep. He was a fearsome man, I'm sure, to meet with a club in his hand. What he says to Saul is that he can't wear Saul's armor because he's not used to them and has not practiced with them. Isn't that equally true for us today? To be good with all of these weapons, but especially the shield of faith. We must practice with our armor and with our weapons. Even the demons, you see, know that there's a God. If your faith is just simply assent to the fact that there's a deity out there, that's not any good to you at all. We see how it is that the devil even knows how to quote the Bible. What will you do when you face the real enemy? Well, we must practice. And how do we practice? Well, the church encourages us all the days of our life in many different ways. That's why it is that the Episcopal Church, the traditional church, the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, in all of her support of us with our prayer, with our sacraments, with our feasts, with our fasts, with the celebration of Lent, with the joyful shout of Easter, all of these moments are signs and seals to us to encourage our faith. So we are to keep watch. We are to grow in strength and practice with our weapons. And certainly prayer, as I've mentioned to you before, is essential to being practiced with your weapons. If you do not pray, my friends, then you are disarmed in the face of the enemy. To pray not only with your Christian brothers and sisters, but for them, asking God's care for each one, for our children, yes, for our leaders, not only in the church, but also in our nation and the world. The very act of prayer, you see, is strengthening your faith. But remember that the battle is to be fought not alone, but as part of the army. You cannot win against the devil by yourself. The church is God's army. To remain with holy company is one of the most essential components to fighting the battle for victory. We gather together each Sunday, yes, but if your Christian commitment is simply an hour each Sunday morning, then you are outside the company. Anyone who knows anything about being in the military, and I know very little, I never served in the military, but you must stay with your company, and you must keep your post. If you go wandering off because you decided that it was a good day to go investigate, that's probably not a good idea. The church is the same way. We gather with the apostles. We gather with the prophets and martyrs. We gather with the holy church throughout all the world. We are flanked, perhaps like the cavalry in Napoleon's day, we are flanked by the angels and archangels who protect us from above. You see, departing the church and saying, I can be a Christian on my own, is not an expression of Christian maturity. It's not. This is your post. These are your people. This is your army. Leaving the church is foolish. It is abandoning your post. My friends, God has blessed us, has surrounded us with so great a cloud of witnesses, but we must be sure that we are at battle. And we have been given the victory already. So let us take upon ourselves the shield of faith and all of the armor that God has given to us, that we might hear his words, "Well done, good and faithful soldier." Amen.